Welcome to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. My name is Fregal Barron. Every week I speak to leading sustainability thinkers and practitioners, scientists, economists, NGOs, business leaders and investors. We discuss the sustainability imperative, the key challenges, the latest thinking, and what's working in sustainability, resilience and regeneration. I'm very pleased today to welcome Professor Maísa Roja to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. Maísa was the scientific coordinator for the COP25 Climate Summit and director of Chile's Center for Climate and Resilience Research. She's also associate professor at the Department of Geophysics at the University of Chile. Maísa's two main research areas are paleoclimate, the study of past climates, and regional climate change. Thank you very much for joining me today, Maísa, on the Sustainability Agenda podcast.
Hello, thank you for the invitation.
Now, you've been extremely busy, I know, over the last few weeks and probably longer, particularly in the context of COP25. Can you maybe just for listeners introduce yourself, talk a little bit about what you do and your background, and then we can maybe move and focus on the big, exciting and dramatic activities around COP25?
Well, I'm a climate scientist. I studied physics as an undergraduate and I have a PhD in physics as well. And then I have gradually moved more into climate, and I have done, I have worked on loads of different topics actually for a long time. I consider myself a paleoclimatologist, so studying the long-term history of the climate on the planet. But I work with models, which means that I can study the past, the present, and the future. Since the beginning of this year, I'm director of a center that's called Center for Climate and Resilience Research. And it is an interdisciplinary research center where there are climatologists, but we also have anthropologists, lawyers, economists, etc. And since the beginning of the year as well, I was asked to coordinate a scientific committee for COP25. The role of this committee was and still is to provide input, scientific input into the work of COP. That was then so directly towards the actual event of the COP, but also a lot, and that's where we most spent our energy in, into the national agenda that moved around the fact that Chile was hosting COP25.
Right, right. Very interesting. You mentioned this interdisciplinary group. Resilience. Why resilience and how important is resilience? Maybe just before we go on to the COP.
Yes. So resilience has a number of definitions. Sort of the intuitive definition is when you perturb a system, the system sort of bounces back to equilibrium. It sort of reaccommodates itself. And we see climate change as one big disturber of whatever our societies are trying to do. And in the case of Chile and in the case of many other societies that are still in development, we are trying to deal at the same time with the inequalities, with poverty, with the development in general. And now we have climate change as a big sort of boundary condition that will increase and amplify all our vulnerabilities that we already have. So how do we develop a society? How do we understand and how we develop a society that becomes resilient and can do better in this context is critical.
Now, that's very interesting because the COP location of the COP moved from Chile, and you wrote about recently some of the conditions, economic conditions and the inequality in Chile. Now, to what extent do you think that the conditions on the ground in Chile reflect some of the key themes and issues that we need to think about when we think about climate change?
They are actually very much in the middle of this whole problem. As I said in that article, I mean, many of the aspects that have been on the high level demands are pension and access to better salaries and access to better health and stuff like that, that you would not immediately connect to climate change. But we are here because we have constructed, we are here as humanity. We have constructed a way of development that has brought development. Yes, I'm sure there are many indicators that have improved throughout the last 150 years or so. But at the same time, it has been done with a huge consequences on our environment, and in many countries, huge consequences and divides between a small group of people who have gained all of those things that we have developed, and others that haven't. So it has been at the expense of loads of people, of loads of regions, of parts of the society who have just not developed in the same way. That's sort of in the big picture with the global north and the global south, but between in countries as well, or in cities as well. Our cities are in general also very unequal.
Yeah. Now, Chile has had a very particular history with respect to, I guess, what some people call neoliberal economics, a very extreme form of economics, and has a very extreme Gini coefficient. Inequality is very significant in the economy. Is that a big factor now in terms of what's happening on the ground, the consequences of that? Are there moves, are people, is, I guess, what you might call civil society or any part of society really getting to grips with this and trying to deal with this?
Yes, exactly. That's what it is. So loads of accomplishments, but all these accomplishments really concentrated in a very, very small part of the population. And this is actually not the first time that we have had these some movement. I mean, I was just amazed by seeing an extract of a TV programs back to 2011, 7 years ago, 8 years ago, where we had some strikes as well. They were more focused on education, but there was a lot of themes that were discussed there. And it's amazing to see that 8 years ago, you could see it and hang on, these are exactly the same topics that we are discussing now, which meant that there was a little crisis. Some of the topics were picked up and somehow solved, but most of them weren't. And so this is just sort of a rebound of the same demands. So we hope that with this level of crisis now, that we will be able to really tackle them in a profound way, not superficially anymore.
Yes. Now, COP25, what were your expectations as to what might be achieved? Can you give us a little bit of an overview of what you expected, and maybe it's a lot to bite off, but one or two aspects of what you think was achieved?
Yeah, I guess so. I have to say that I'm generally a very positive person. So I always see, so for example, with this crisis, I think, oh, there's a lot of good things that are going to come out if we handle this well. And I guess with this COP and all of the COPs, really, I mean, or let's, they always deliver not enough. But I guess here, I mean, in the last 2 years, there has been this, for me, and this is speaking as a climatologist, there's been this incredibly amounting evidence that climate change is not something of the future anymore. It is so present. It is so now that we are living the consequences and the impacts, that it just requires a very, very urgent and quick and ambitious action, and I mean we started talking about climate emergency or climate urgency or climate crisis this year. We were not talking in these terms mainstream, at least even last year, I would say. So there was really a need to move things quickly. And as actually always happens, things do not move quickly. And it is just really, really frustrating. And it's really frustrating when you see that the parties, how they're called in that process, right? No one wants to move quickly. No one wants to address climate change with the urgency that is required, and everyone is just looking at their own interests, and that is very, very frustrating. To the point that I just don't know. I mean, I think the whole UN system is also in a crisis, or multilateralism in the way that it was set up. I don't know, 70 years ago after the Second World War, it probably did a good job at some time, but now we have to think about different ways of governance and moving forward.
Can you talk specifically about what your role involved, and have you any insights into what you learned through this group you were coordinating?
Yeah. So as I said, the scientific committee. So we saw ourselves as having a mandate to provide input into the negotiation, into the COP, with the science part in particular. But where we mostly worked was really on the national agenda. So Chile had a really full national agenda going on at the same time as organizing the COP. So there was a discussion. So Chile committed to being carbon neutral by 2050. This was going to be included in a framework law on climate change. We were updating our NDC, our national determined contributions, ahead of 2020 to show ambition, and a number of other other issues as well, like updating our national adaptation plans, etc., etc. So I would say that's where we mostly concentrated our work, and it was very interesting. It was I think we learned a lot, but we have to now think how all this effort can be institutionalized. Because so we were appointed like an ad hoc committee for COP25. We identified all these things that I mentioned where we could be of help. So, for example, the update of the NDC. But of course, it's the environmental ministry who has the mandate to actually update the NDC. So we sort of knocked at their door and asked. I think we can help here with evidence, and we can help with making this. And they said yes, sure. But it was all sort of done on a voluntary basis, and not very clear how much our input was going to be included or not. So it had its pros and cons, and I think. But overall, I would say very positive, because also. We, and I'm saying here, we were eight people in this committee. We were able to call up open the scientific community in Chile. And we got response from over 600 scientists. And I tell you, if you had asked me last year how many scientists work in Chile in climate change, I would have said 100. I had no idea there were so many people working on climate change in one and another way. And so that was an incredible experience of being able to connect with all these people through workshops, to helping to. We wrote 19 reports that we are now finishing up in lots of different subjects. Now the question is, So all of this was done on a voluntary basis. How can this be somehow institutionalized so that the state can count with scientific evidence for the decision making, and thereby hopefully have make better decisions?
Yes, it's very interesting. I think it's Mike Hume who talks about some of the issues around the model of diplomacy, model of change that is at the heart of, the governance for the COPs and other initiatives like that. The Kyoto approach generally being based on some false analogies in terms of maybe what was achieved with the ozone problem and so forth, and suggesting that it's not really the right structure, the right model to go forward. Did you see some shortcomings in the structure of how it operates? I mean, you're talking about this problem that many countries are waiting for other countries to take action, and whatever the nationally determined contributions are way off what would be necessary to limit warming to 1.5, and obviously countries seem at the moment reluctant to step forward and make more commitments. There's inevitably, as you say, some kind of disappointment even in successful COPs in terms of what expectations are and were. And I know that a senior person from Greenpeace was saying that in the 25 years that they'd been a COP, they'd never seen a bigger gap between what was happening within and without. Now, I guess that's also a reflection of how the mood has changed, as you say, within even a year. And, you know, Greta Thunberg, Sunrise Movement, Extinction Rebellion, climate, the actual weather and so forth. There's obviously significant momentum and there's been change. But I guess within the COP itself, was this evident that there was that this a kind of disappointment as well?
Yes, absolutely. Now, there are two good things, though, trying to be optimistic here. So at COP20, when we were moving towards Paris and everyone was expecting that there would be an agreement, at that point, someone, I don't really know who it was, but some very bright people who were thinking about this Paris agreement, we have to say it has a completely different structure than the Kyoto Protocol and how we address the ozone hole and all of that. Huh? It is different. So that is a good thing. So they invented this the role of the champion. Yeah. And so the COPs, apart from having a president, they have a champion as well. And this champion is someone who is from the country as well. And this person is in charge of mobilizing all the rest of the world, the non-state actors in the UNFCCC language, which means so the private sector, civil society, the regions, the cities, the local governments, etc. And it makes a lot of sense because I don't know if it was thought about, is this a plan B? I mean, if countries are too slow to move, then we have someone who can mobilize all this rest of society who is actually very important to mobilize and it might be quicker. I don't know. But the thing is that, so there was a lot of progress in that respect. And to the point that actually the role of the champion was only set up to 2020, and they have in recognizing that the role of the champion has been so important and so positive, they have extended the mandate for another 5 years. So in each of the next five COPs, there will be a champion, someone who will be in charge of mobilizing basically the rest of the world. And think about how critical this is now that the U.S. is trying to get out or doing all the movements to stepping out of the Paris Agreement. You can still have action with the states and cities in the US. So that, I think, it's, for example, a very positive outcome, and it speaks about new ways of governance. So the other positive outcome of this COP is a very slow movement towards bringing together the climate change convention and the biodiversity one. And I think that's very positive now that we know that climate change is affecting our biodiversity so strongly that we cannot continue to work on these two aspects as being completely separate. So I would say that those are two important little steps, positive steps forward that were achieved at this COP.
Yes. I think there's been some interesting research around the relationship between scientific knowledge and values and attitudes to climate change, whether better information, the idea of a cognitive deficit, that if people understood better what was actually happening, there'd be significantly more motivation, understanding, willingness to change and so forth. And some of the research seems to suggest that actually it's very much about values and less about actual levels of information. And in fact, sometimes the what we might call the veering towards climate denialism are often very well informed, actually, or better informed, maybe scientifically, than others. But actually, it's really comes down to an essential question at the heart of this about values and people's values. I mean, it's also correlated, I think, between attitudes to economics, more right wing and more left wing, more should we say more interventionist and less interventionist, and so forth. And I'm just wondering, in that sense, what is the changing or ongoing role of the scientist is, in the sense that it's tremendously important to understand, to you know, get better insights and so forth, and what's happening, and to communicate as well, and at the same time, that's not enough. It's very important to find other ways to communicate, I guess, and integrate it into stories, integrate it in I guess what they call thicker kind of contexts to try and create change and or motivate people to start changing their behavior.
Yes, I completely agree. Me coming from a physics background, for a long time, I didn't understand what are we doing, or why are we not doing anything? We have all the facts, right? So a very naive way of understanding the world of like, well, you know, I have the facts here, I understand it, hence I have to act, right? And it's clear that it's not that easy, and I agree that it is more about values than facts. But I say this a bit of laughing about myself here, but I think we still have a lot of scientists who still sort of think that it is enough to write papers and having the facts and having the evidence, right? And that we, so in that sense, I think this year has also been an important we have learned a lot from this year. I don't know if I can actually answer your question, but I have this there's this paradox going on for me in particular, and it's that, so we have had the IPCC from before the UNFCCC, right? It was the first IPCC report that actually led to having the Convention on Climate Change. And since the IPCC reports have been actually very influential in the UNFCCC process. But the IPCC reports are, okay, they are thorough, they are robust, the process has improved, etc. But I would say the last three special reports of the IPCC, the special report on 1.5 degree of warming, the special report on land and on oceans, they are of a different, I would say, I don't know if the word is quality or relevance. I think in probably because they were produced between the different working groups. Hence, they in one report they could convey the whole complex structure in that is around climate change and deliver a message that is so relevant. So we have sort of an IPCC that has improved enormously, and at the same time, none of the reports has been welcomed by the UNFCCC process. So science is becoming more relevant. Science is somehow understanding that it has to go a bit beyond of what they were doing in the last 30 years. And at the same time, the countries are just don't want to hear about it. So it is. I'm not sure how to understand this and how to what is going to happen with this situation at this moment. I'm now involved in the full report of the sixth assessment cycle in working group one and I think it is a very strange moment to be doing this report, because we're doing it, we feel that we're becoming more relevant, the reports are being discussed a lot, but they're not discussed where they should be discussed, which is in the realm of the convention and taking action according to what the reports say.
Yes, it's very interesting. I suppose as you get closer to the reality of the kinds of changes that are going to be necessary, people, then you start probably to see people putting the brakes on and things like that happening, rather than the kinds of changes that are going to be necessary. I guess that's another interesting question, the degree to which a lot of time and energy has gone into, I guess, a pretty polarized situation to try and provide the evidence to convince people, skeptics, whatever you might call them. And yet the time frame in which we need to implement decisions to take action is getting shorter and shorter, and there are unforeseen consequences of decisions that are made, the kinds of changes. How comfortable do you feel that we know what to do and we're comfortable with the kinds of decisions that need to be made?
We just have to mobilize all of our society in a very, very quick way. And the truth is that what the 1.5 report says, the special report, is unprecedented change at a scale that we have never done before, or something like that, right? It's true that is the truth, and we have never done it before. I'm not sure we know how to do it. We know that we have the technology, we have we have the technical feasibility for the transformation. We know the economics of it. All that part, the technical part, we know, but the social and political aspects of the transformation that we have to that we have to implement, we don't really know, and that is something that is so clear, and it became to me so clear with what happened in Chile, and there are so many examples around the world that of wanting to implement the technical aspects towards this transformation, and then people fighting back because they haven't been asked, basically, to agree with this.
It's a huge governance question as well, isn't it?
Exactly, it is a huge governance question, and it has, and it would be a lot easier if we share values. If we share values, then you will be able to convince people, and you will be able to build those governance structures that are probably not centralized anymore. You know, some of them will be, other will be completely decentralized, other will be polycentric, you know, like at different levels, giving people a lot more flexible, they have to be flexible, because we're talking about the next 30 years of these unprecedented changes.
Yes, I think it's very interesting, and I know, I don't know whether you're familiar with, you probably are, Steve Rayner, and some of the work he's done. Very interesting looking at governance and suggesting that there's at least three sets of clusters of values you could talk about, which need to somehow be involved. He's suggesting rather than trying to change people's values, is trying to craft governance mechanisms that take into account and meet people's values, existing values, one which might be more market oriented, one which might be more bureaucratic, and one set of values which might be more egalitarian. And he's looked at mixed governance systems that bring together elements of each of those, and therefore different parties, different sets of values can be incorporated and included. But this work on values just seems to be tremendously important, working, you know, where people are today.
I guess the traditional scientists working on climate change, sort of from my background, would 2 years ago, I would have never thought I would have to be talking about values. But I just mentioned to you that, so I'm coordinating lead author of chapter one, which is the context and framing chapter for the working group one contribution to the sixth assessment report. That's a very long title.
What's that about?
It's so for the next IPCC report, working group one, which is the physical science basis. In right. Chapter one, we will have a box. We will actually be talking about values in climate science. So, and that's something that, I mean, a couple of years ago, you would have never thought. I mean, maybe working group two, who talks about impacts and vulnerability and people, they might be talking about values. But working group one, we talk about models and projections. But we are now including text on perceptions, on values, on storylines, like different ways of communicating science, etc. So I mean, even for us, we have been definitely being pushed outside of our comfort zone of the traditional areas of expertise that scientists, the typical working group one IPCC scientist has. And I think that's very interesting.
Very interesting. Absolutely. Absolutely. Can you talk a little bit about this question of adaptation versus mitigation? I know it's not versus, actually, and they're all, you know, that we need to be having lots of different approaches at the same time. There's been a lot of focus on mitigation. Adaptation seems to be tremendously important, yet has maybe arguably been neglected to some extent. I don't know whether what you think about that generally.
Yeah, okay. I hear here, I'm definitely not an expert. I have learned a lot this year, because one of the tables that we coordinated is, of course, was on adaptation. Yes, so traditionally, the two big pillars about addressing climate change, you know, you have to address the causes of climate change, and that's mitigation, but also the impacts of climate change, and that's adaptation. Adaptation always has been sort of the poor brother or sister of the two of them. I guess because for a number of reasons, I guess for once it's that we, until very recently, we kind of thought that, well, we will have to adapt at some point in the future, right? Climate change until very recently was still something that was occurring in the future. And that has dramatically changed, and now even rich countries are seeing that they need to adapt to the consequences now. But then because they are so specific to locally specific, I guess it's also different to quantify them and having kind of metrics and indicators of advancement. So it's all more, I guess, more qualitative than quantitative. And I guess we are always better, or, well, why did I say we? I mean, the physical scientists are of course much better with dealing with quantitative subjects rather than, and maybe we haven't given the social scientists enough space here to and maybe it has been a research gap as well. I don't know.
Yes, I think what you're talking about is more holistic, more cross-disciplinary approaches, which are growing and are tremendously important. I think what I found striking was the idea that what we do today won't impact the climate system for possibly, I don't know, 40, 50 years. That idea that it's decades into the future, really, it's quite a challenging proposition to get to think about. But also in terms of strategies, in terms of, you know, thinking about things like carbon sinks. I know geoengineering's been, you know, still around and growing, getting growing attention. But in Chile, I know there's been new initiatives in Patagonia, for example.
Yeah, I mean, we have been fortunate in Chile that so we don't have fossil fuels basically, which was really terrible for a long time, because our energy was very expensive because we had to import all of that, and we had lots of hydropower, but it has increasingly decreases his share in our energy matrix as well, because of a really long ongoing drought as well. But then at some point, all our renewable energy potential started to become a reality, just not only a potential, but a reality. And that has been incredibly positive, because it has so many co-benefits with prices, with the cleaner cities, so that part of addressing climate change has been very positive. That's why in general in Chile it has been easy to convince people that we can be carbon neutral, and that it would be very good as well for us to be carbon neutral, because we will have to increase the share of renewable energies, and that has still in this traditional way, still thinking about growth, can be kind of easily being sold to.
Yes, this question of more tangible projects which have economic benefits to the local community, to the country. And, you know, biting off at that size is a successful strategy, because, as you say, people can understand the benefits. They can see the benefits, and of course the economics have changed pretty dramatically and are continuing to in terms of renewable energy. But that's very interesting. Yeah. It seems that from the very earliest days that the climate predictions, the predictions of carbon, the impact of carbon dioxide on temperature and so forth, has been pretty robust over quite some time. What we've seen has you know, met the expectations. On the other hand, the impact of these changes have been much greater than people expected. I'm just wondering, what that might suggest, either in terms of areas that we need to research from a scientific perspective, or just generally what your thoughts might be on that.
Yeah, I mean, exactly what you just said is one of, I would say, the main conclusions from the IPCC report. So actually in my chapter, that's where you can find, like, how have previous projections compared to what has actually happened. And yes, our projections have always been actually quite good, quite robust. But we have underestimated the impacts. In that acknowledgement, it's quite important for us, because basically, yeah, what they're saying is, we as climate scientists, we have been being very conservative actually with what would happen, and that has to make us to rethink the way we are looking at impacts. And you will see in the next report a lot more emphasis, not in the median changes, but on the tails, you know, on the tails that are maybe improbable, but have high, high impacts. And that's where we have to pay a lot more attention to when we analyze our projections, when we analyze, basically, yeah, look, like, where is it that the impacts could be highest? Where are the most vulnerable communities? Where is the huge exposures? Paying a lot more attention to that types of research or questions. I think that's we're a bit in depth around those, and we will have to focus.
What's next for you? What are you working on? What kind of research projects?
I need a holiday first. I've learned so much this year. I mean, so I never mentioned the seven topics that we addressed, but it was mitigation, adaptation, sort of transversal, and then sectorially it was water, biodiversity, cities, oceans, and cryosphere. So I learned a lot about all these seven topics, in particular biodiversity, which is something that I had of course less idea, and there's added just so many ideas of things that we have to pursue and publish, and it's actually quite exciting to start to have a little bit of time to reflect first, and then to pursue all of these super interesting project that were initiated this year. Lots of people that I met as well, etc. I can't even start thinking about all of it.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Maïssa. Thank you for your time today, the great work and dedication and commitment and hard work on the COPs, not least. I really appreciate your time. Wish you the best with your ongoing research.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. I hope you found it interesting. It would be great if you could leave a review and share the podcast on social media. You can sign up at iTunes to make sure you don't miss any future episodes.